This is ARRL's Eclectic Tech, a bi-weekly look at the technical and scientific side of amateur radio with your host Steve Ford, WB8IMY. Eclectic Tech is brought to you by ICOM. ICOM, for the love of ham radio, is about the passion for an incredible hobby. Visit ICOM in the community webpage at www.icomamerica.com/community.
I'm on the telephone with Ron Block, NR2B. Good morning, Ron.
Good morning, Steve.
Ron, you have a really interesting article in the July 2022 issue of QST Magazine, in which you describe basically how a lightning protection, lightning mitigation grounding system was set up around the clubhouse of the Gloucester County, New Jersey Amateur Radio Club. And you go into some detail in the article, and for me, that's the fascinating part. But before we get to that, for listeners who may not recognize your call sign, Ron, could you give us just a little bit of history? Because you've been involved in what I might facetiously call the lightning business for quite some time.
Oh, yes. Well, it started way back. I worked for a computer manufacturer. Retired after 25 years working for them. But about midway through the process, there was a major layoff in our organization. And I looked around and said, I need a backup plan. Now, fortunately, I was not one of the ones laid off, but all of my staff and all of my bosses were. So I had to go figure out what to do. So I decided to, at that point in time, to become a distributor of the Polyphaser products. Now, I have a sort of a backdoor into that process in that Roger Block, KD7UT as Silent Key, was the creator and developer of the Polyphaser product line. And so he was nice enough to say, yeah, even though you're my brother, I'll let you be a distributor. So, yes, I was a distributor for them for 31 years. And with direct access to the knowledge base that existed in my brother's head. He trained me and taught me a great deal about the process. And then partway through the 31 years or so, I spent a great deal of time in the field actually doing site visitations and making recommendations and seeing that they were completed and observing the differences between the unprotected and the protected sites.
Now, veteran amateurs, myself among them, are very familiar with the name Polyphaser. But for those that aren't, can you tell me a little bit about the product?
Well, it's kind of interesting. Roger was a new graduate from Drexel University and had a job in Florida. I don't remember the exact company name. It's one of the antenna providers that's in the Kissimmee, Orlando area. And he was tasked with building a piece of electronics that required an antenna. So he built the product, that, you know, got it ready, and then their testing lab and the use of the antenna was at a on the roof of the building. So he went up there, connected it to the antenna, and proceeded to go through the process of testing whatever this device was supposed to do. The day ended, and he said, good, come back tomorrow. Except tomorrow, in the intervening time, was a lightning storm which struck the antennas. And when he arrived the next day, there was a pile of cinders in place of the product that he was testing. So that actually occurred two more days in a row.
Jeez.
So he then had the idea, I think I have to do something about this. So that was the genesis of the original coax protector. Which was, you know, a pair of, in this case, UHF connectors, female type, on a an aluminum block with a gas tube in series with the center. I'm sorry, with a capacitor in series with the center pin, and then a gas tube from the antenna side to ground. So that was the original protector. And heck, my kids, as they were growing up, would rotate through his garage on the summer vacations while they would run drill presses and, you know, do various things that were associated with the business.
Huh.
And I guess it wasn't until maybe 30 years later that I step back and look at the fact that basically Roger created the coaxial aspects of the whole lightning protection industry. I mean, they always had down conductors and things like this, but for protecting of the communications equipment, he was really the originator of that process.
And a name that is well known to this day.
Well, the name has a little history to it, too. Back at that time, you had to, when you got a phone, you had to register it with a name, a real human's name. So he figured out Polly was the first name and Phaser was the second name or the last name.
So ergo Polyphaser. Yep.
Yes. And two caps, two cap P's in it.
That's
no
right.
Space.
That's right. In the case of the club, getting back to the Gloucester County Club there, according to your article, as I read it, you were facing a challenging situation in terms of really making a robust lightning protection system, because as I understand it, the club had a tower for HF, a tower for VHF. They were grounded, but there was no external to the building ground connection within the clubhouse itself, just the AC ground. Is that right?
Basically, yes. It started with the gift of a 1.5 kilowatt amplifier by one of the members. It was donated at the behest of a friend of his. It was his mentor, and they read the book on the instructions for installation and said, "Yep, must have a ground." Well, we looked at it and said, "Yep, we've got a ground, but trouble is we have about 6 or 7 of them, and they're all independent and not interconnected." And thereby hung the whole issue of we've got to go and fix that process. Okay, yes, each tower, the two major towers had their own ground rods associated with them. Several smaller towers all had ground rods associated with them. And of course, the AC, the utility folks put in a ground there. So, you know, all these non-interconnected grounds. And as the article basically, I think, says, well, it's been a while since I've read it even, if you take a radio and plug it into an AC, you know, take the simplest radio in the world, plug it into AC, okay, you're connecting to one of the grounds. You're connected to the utility ground.
Yes.
Now, if you take a coax cable and bring it off of a tower, which also has a ground on it, and connect it to that radio, you've now connected the radio to a second ground. Mm. And now if you're unfortunate enough to have a local lightning strike, you know, into the ground even, it doesn't have to be on anything in particular, you now have, as that energy begins to dissipate, you get voltage differences between the two grounds. And that voltage difference can be very substantial, you know, into the thousands of volts. And of course, your radio plugged into the connected to an antenna and plugged into the AC is connected to two of those grounds, and the voltage difference is going to be equalized through the radio. So that's sort of the genesis and the driving factor of trying to unite all the grounds within the clubhouse.
So you were basically attempting to create a zone of protection for both the HF and the VHF radio rooms.
Right. They're fairly small rooms, so they're not huge. And so, yes, we decided, okay, we'll create a room around the HF side, which is the one that's documented in the article. And then we're actually in process, including this coming weekend, of continuing the process on the VHF side. And we did that creation of that zone of protection for the entire room because we really can't predict, as would be in a standard or a usual HF station, we can't predict what's going to happen. The room has a room for 3 operating positions. Only one of them is utilized. But the others, occasionally, if somebody walks in with a rig, says, "Hey, I'd like to try this on your, whiz-bang antenna," fine, we can accommodate that. Or if somebody has to do a repair on a radio or something like that, they can work at the bench behind, and they also have access to the antenna systems. So we tried to be fairly flexible in designing the system that way.
And what a system it is. When I was looking at, I think it was figure 4, I noticed that You have a grounded perimeter, if you will, around the entire building. Did you actually have to dig a trench to lay that conductor?
Well, we haven't gotten that far yet. Okay, we put the system into the HF room. We're working currently on the exact equivalent of that in the VHF side. Now, once that's and those two systems are independently grounded to the outside world, the next step in the process then is to start to bond all the grounds together, and that's where we come into this thing called a perimeter ground, which basically has two functions. The first function is to equalize, actually say it this way, to act as a shorting bar, to equalize the voltage under the structure. Okay, if you take a hit on an antenna, for example, it's going to come down and begin to radiate out from that antenna. So it's going to catch the one edge of the building and begin to elevate it significantly.
Yes.
The other end of the building doesn't know it's coming. So therefore, the energy or the electrons are going to have the potential to jump onto the building frame because it's a better conductor. It happens to be I-beam steel. So it's now going to use the building as a more conductive path than the earth. And that byproduct has damaging effects to the building and its inhabitants and all the electronics inside. So we use the shorting bar called a perimeter ground to equalize or help equalize that voltage difference. And then the second item that the perimeter ground does is it gives you the opportunity to bond all of the other external grounds, such as the two towers, the two or three local towers that are there, the propane tank, and the utility ground. So it just gives you a chance to interconnect and bond all those. Now you have, at least for the building, from the building's perspective, a completely unified ground system. Okay, then we'll extend that perimeter ground so that it ties in with the radials on each of the two tall towers.
I was going to mention, I saw, and of course read the description in the article, about, and I'm going to get this wrong, Ron, single point ground panel, is that correct?
SPGP, yes.
Yes.
I can type that in my sleep without looking at the keys now.
Well, before we started recording, you had mentioned that you are getting emails in response to your article with a number of people asking, well, if I want to install such a thing, where do I put it? And what are you telling them generally?
I'm telling them that it's a hard decision process sometimes. Okay, there's a couple of ways of doing it, and it's all based on the premise that you understand what the single point ground panel and its mounted protectors do. So let me just sort of start there. The job of a protector is relatively straightforward. It's to short the conductors of the cable that it's in series with to the case of the protector. That's all it does. So in the case of the coax, it takes the center pin and shorts it to the shield, where the shield is already mounted or already connected to the protector. In the case of the AC power, it takes the hot and the neutral and shorts them to the case of the protector, which is also the ground conductor. So with that in mind, as the individual's protectors, if they are mounted on a conductive surface, the single point ground panel, as we've called it, then all of the conductors to the radio basically are shorted together. So the radio is connected to the outside world, you know, during the strike event with a single logical conductor because everything's shorted.
Oh, okay.
And that's the key ingredient in the whole process. You've got to be able to protect the radio and make sure that the current does not flow among or within the conductors of that radio. Now, that's not to say that the radio still stays at ground potential, because it doesn't. It will be elevated in some cases up to almost 10,000 volts above a local ground, but there's no current flow because it's a static build because of all the conductors being shorted together. So that's the whole premise behind the single point ground panel and mounting of the protectors. Now, the panel itself can be any conductive surface. It can be aluminum, copper, steel, whatever metal is fancy for you today. And it can be any shape, any size. However, I would caution that as you start to spread protectors out, 4, 5, 10, 15 feet, you start to introduce a little bit of the speed of light into the process, where electrons travel at about a foot per nanosecond. And then when you get too many nanoseconds out of time, you have issues with the protectors not closing all or close to the same time, and you allow some current to begin to flow through the radio. And after a while, if it's a very short period, you've maybe just done some very transitory damage, such as maybe erode part of an integrated circuit or part of a conductor within a transistor. However, if you let it go a few more nanoseconds, it actually can open that conductor or fuse that conductor open and cause a complete failure in the system.
I never thought about the time factor, especially in nanoseconds, that could be a serious thing.
Yeah, it does. It does. In fact, one of the things from my consulting side is you go into the sites and they said, about 6 months ago we had a lightning strike, and now we're experiencing equipment failure. Hmm. And there is a latent damage issue associated with it, where it does a partial destruction or a partial meltdown of, some silicon, but not enough to kill the device outright. But it does fail eventually.
Huh. Well, what about somebody, Ron, like me, who just, I'm an ordinary ham, stations on the second floor of my house. short of disconnecting my antenna whenever there's a thunderstorm in the area, is there anything else I could be doing in terms of helping to protect myself?
Well, you just raised a big red flag for me.
Okay.
Do not, under any circumstances, disconnect that antenna and just sort of leave the coax hanging around.
Ah.
If you were to take a direct strike on that antenna, yes, it's going to follow the coax cable. And sort of like cars on the freeway, it's going to come and they're all going to line up and push each other down that freeway till they get to the end of that cable. And then once they get there, they're literally going to spray into the room.
Oh.
And find any other path to be aground.
Hmm. Including me.
Yeah. Unfortunately, yeah. Oh, of course. Of course. the average lightning strike is somewhere around 5 or 6 miles. So that's a tremendous potential. And so short distances, a switch in series with the coax line, it's not there. It's going to blow right through that. And it's going to blow right off the end of the cable into the room. So as a minimum, I would strongly recommend the creation of a single point ground panel with the appropriate protectors, as is depicted in the article, and leave the antenna always connected to that surge arrestor or that protector.
Okay.
That way, at least it's got a path to some kind of a ground. Now, whether second floor shacks are a little hard because you really can't get to an earth ground very easily in most cases. And if you attempt to do it, you have to use something that's fairly wide, like a foot wide copper strap to be that conductor, just to get the inductance down a little bit so that you've got half a chance of getting that RF signal resulting from the lightning strike into a ground system. It sort of triggers me to say that the center frequency or the mean frequency on the lightning strike, when you take into consideration the rise time of the pulse and the ringing associated with the cables and antennas and things like this, puts a signal that's in the 1 megahertz, 500 kc to about 1.5 megs. As RF. Yes, it's got a great DC component to it, but it also has a substantial RF component to it. And of course, the DC, yeah, you can handle that on a wire of reasonable size. But
yes.
The RF side, you can't. It's a choke at that point in time. So you start to think about, okay, how do I do it? And, you know, inch and a half, or I'm sorry, 6-inch, 12-inch wide copper strap is at least an attempt to get the least inductive conductor you can. Getting that through a wall from a middle room to the outside is next to impossible.
I can imagine.
But yeah, the general recommendation for second story inner rooms and things like this where you don't have access to the outside is to just use the AC ground as your ground point, recognizing that it is not an RF ground, not even close, but it is at least a DC ground and will eventually drain off the equipment elevation so that it comes back to the normal ground level potentials.
Excellent advice, Rod.
Tune in again for the next episode of Eclectic Tech, produced by ARRL, the National Association for Amateur Radio. Music is provided by Purple Planet at purpleplanet.com. If you have comments, email eclectic@arrl.org. This episode is copyright ARRL and all rights are reserved. I'm Sabrina Jackson, KC1JMW. See you next time.